This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome to regular and new listeners. This is Lana, and I appreciate you taking the time to be here today. I have to say, I was really pleased to meet an entirely new crowd of people after my last interview with Tim Murdoch. You know who you are. What a well-rounded, grounded, intelligent, and funny crowd you are, so a big hello to you. My guest today is Craig Fitzgerald, who is one of the founders of the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance of New York. What I really appreciate about Craig is that we can discuss not only anarchism, but also spiritualism, conspiracy, and suppressed history, which we will touch upon. We'll discuss the nationalist anarchist movement and how it can solve a multitude of problems we're currently facing. What makes up a nation? And why is culture, customs, value, and heritage important to a nation? What is encoded into our ethnic identity? Why is multiculturalism being forced by government into white countries? And why the heck are rabbis painting swastikas on temples? These are just a few of the things we'll be talking about, so stick around. Welcome, Craig. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Lana. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, first off, I have to congratulate yet another guest of mine who's managed to make it on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. Congrats, Craig. You are a white supremacist.
Am I on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website these days? Is NADA? I don't know. I don't know if we are, but I know I've been targeted by them for a long time for multiple associations before NADA.
When I need to find interesting guests, I should just go to the SPLC website and check their intelligence reports for dangerous people, because I like all the people that they warn us about.
Indeed. I have to say that I would agree with you. I've found many good folks through looking through the that intelligence report, as the SPLC calls it.
It's funny. Well, I invited you here today so we can discuss the nationalist anarchist movement, which many, one, have never heard about, two, believe it entails the state, and three, think that it's a Nazi ideology. So how about we begin by defining what a nation is?
Well, nation comes from the word, its etymology, its root word is the Latin natio, and this root word, its meaning means that which has been born, and it is also the root word for the words natural, native, naval, things like that, nativity, etc. So you could see it has to do with things that have been born. So right off the bat, what is national, what is a nation, it's really people.
Yeah.
People make up nations, and people are very connected to the land that they're from, you know, being native to a certain soil. And there's definitely something to that. It's not to say that people can't move around or anything like that and have new, you know, homelands and such. But there's a very organic, natural, holistic connection between people and the land. And I think that that's what true nationhood is the connection between people and the land. And so when we talk about nation, I believe it just to be the community, we the people, nothing more, not the state, and not arbitrary borders or anything like that.
Exactly. I would say a nation is, it's made up of people in a region who share similar values and heritage, which it brings a natural order and harmony to the people who make up that region. So
indeed,
it has nothing to do with the state. Explain how the anarchist part comes in with nationalism, because this is not a statist, socialist, or fascist ideology.
Well, basically, anarchism comes from the Greek anarchos, which means no rulers, not no rules, not no government, not chaos, which is what many people think that it has those meanings, but it means no rulers. So in many ways, I believe that translates also to another Greek word, or Greek-derived word, autarky, which means self-rule. And I believe that anarchism, having no rulers, means ultimately self-rule, an individual ruling themselves. So when we mix the words national anarchism, what we're talking about is we're talking about small enclaves of anarchists of different varieties. In an anarchist world, we're going to see a true diversity of communities, and that diversity would be ethnic, it would be racial, it would be religious, it would be economic, it would be social, etc. So different communities could be based on a number of things, and different things, like I said, economic basis or racial basis or religious basis. And the sky's really the limit. Sexual orientation could be the basis, you name it. And so national anarchists are basically pan-anarchists in that sense, that we, but maybe a little less hypocritical than some pan-anarchists because we do include ethno-tribalist mm-hmm. anarchism
yeah.
into this pan-anarchist worldview or milieu that we're speaking and fighting for.
Yeah, and some nationalist anarchists, they are racial separatists, but we should get something straight here. The nationalist anarchist movement, it consists of many races who are interested in preserving their ethnic and ancestral lineage and heritage. So they're not interested in killing other races because of some superiority complex. Yet they acknowledge that we are different and that's okay and we can be separate and still get along in peace, correct?
Correct. And even further than that, the national anarchist movement isn't just for white nationalists and white separatists. There's all different racial separatists involved with national anarchism, just like there's NATA, the group that I'm involved with, the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance. We're not a racial separatist group at all. We have members of all different races and creeds and ethnic national backgrounds. Our nationalism comes from more of an American, you know, there's tradition of being an American, which does have European Anglo-Saxon basis in many ways,
yeah.
but also has other influences, and we talk about that. And so national anarchism can really include any anarchist of any variety, of any hyphenation, even if they choose to use a hyphenation, who's really just not a hypocrite. That is what I've, because, you know, before I was involved with the National Anarchist Movement, that was always my biggest critique of the so-called anarchist movement, was that they were just too utopian and universalist and kind of dogmatic, especially when it came to things like culture and race and religion. And I would always say, and this extends not just for anarchists, but also like libertarians and constitutionalist type-minded people here in the States. And I would say to them, well, what happens tomorrow when we have an anarchist society or a libertarian society and there's people who don't want to live with other populations
mm-hmm.
or, you know, based on whatever reason, you know, it could be homosexuals don't want to live around Christians or something. Why not? What do we do about that? And they would act like it's fine, you know, usually the left-wing people would act like it's fine for so-called oppressed groups, you know, minority groups, brown, black, yellow, anything but white, unless the white people were homosexual or gender questioning, that they had a right to autonomously organize communities and be totally independent and sovereign, but white people
who were
heterosexuals didn't have that right.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that was always something that I questioned, and a lot of people were very hypocritical in their answers. They didn't seem very libertarian and anarchist. They seemed more like fascists and other authoritarians like, you know, the Marxists of different schools.
I just want to live with people who like white people. You know, I'm fed up with cultural Marxism, multiculturalism being pushed down my throat if I don't want it.
Indeed.
Statism,
indeed.
Jewish supremacy, Islamic colonization, Mexican supremacy. I don't want any of it. So I don't want to live with people who tell me I'm a white supremacist for being concerned with my ethnicity and heritage. But this sort of rampant anti-white logical thinking has taken hold of the Western world. Therefore, it's no surprise that there are some whites who are racial separatists. Is it any wonder when so many people hate whites that they want to then go live with their own, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. And actually, you know, like, there's a white nationalist fellow who's associated with NADA. And, you know, he's more of like a kind of populist white nationalist. He believes in the Constitution and, you know, like a minarchist, limited government kind of libertarian white nationalist. I wouldn't call him a straight up anarchist, but he's associated with our alliance, NADA, and he actually doesn't even care about living in a white separatist enclave as much as he doesn't want hit personally to miscegenate and, you know, go outside of his race with his family. Sure. And he doesn't want, like what you just said, the multiculturalism and the anti-whitey stuff pushed down his throat through the media and his children's throat through the media mm-hmm. and the educational system.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Have you been to Europe lately?
I have never been to Europe,
okay.
Actually. I have only traveled in North America into the three nation states that make up North America.
What do you think of when I say Europe?
Europe, what do I think of?
Yeah.
I think of my ancestral homeland that I'm yearning to go back to, but I don't know when I'll have enough revenue to do or money to do so.
Well, I ask because many who are ready to defend multiculturalism have never been to Europe. They think I'm talking about a little immigration into Europe, but I'm talking about mass immigration, hundreds of thousands at a time. Yet these people flop their big fat mouths at me without understanding that Europeans are literally well on their way to becoming a minority in their homelands. Their way of life is being destroyed. And this isn't cultural genocide? And who is allowing mass immigration? Government. So government is the problem here, yet anarchists do not want to touch the subject of race differences and how multiculturalism does not work. Have you noticed this in the anarchist community?
Indeed. Well, I would say first off, you know, a lot of anarchists, since we're not talking about modern nation states, they think somehow that all borders are going to disappear, which is a very utopian thinking. There's borders everywhere. I mean, I have personal borders just around my person and my body.
Sure.
So, you know, I don't really see that how local autonomy and individual autonomy, like anarchists talk about, is somehow going to translate into a borderless world. It actually sounds like more borders than what we have today with the nation states and even with globalization now changing nation states. Now, back to the immigration issue, I do, you know that there is a mass immigration problem in Europe, just like there is here. And I think that's across the West. For a long time, when I was involved in patriot group circles, I supported a lot of border stuff. But the more and more I've come to kind of a nuanced understanding on it, and I can't speak so much for Europe, but I can certainly speak for here in the United States, that I really think that the immigration issue is a done deal in many ways, and that's why national anarchism, or just anarchism in general, or decentralism and local autonomy is essentially the answer to deal with this tide of mass immigration that, like you said, is the product of statism.
Yep.
And even more so, ultra-statism that we call globalization or the New World Order, whatever.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, the Zionist interests and other globalist interests are definitely promoting this to destroy the Western nations, but they're also doing it to destroy the so-called developing third world nations as well. And because if you think about it, many of those people, now maybe not so much in Europe with the Muslims who are immigrating to Europe, but probably to some extent, but definitely with most of the immigration, whether it's Muslim or not, here in the United States, I'd say across the board, the immigration to the United States, it's killing these people's culture. And by the first generation that's born here or brought up here has pretty much thrown his culture away. And
it's not good for anyone. That's what we're saying. This is creating a monoculture, and that's what people don't understand. I mean, and if you're critical of immigrants, you could be slapped with hate speech laws. So the minority is more protected than the majority.
That's totally ridiculous.
And here's the thing that I should say, too. These people have not democratically voted for it. So, again, it's government. And I think that these immigrants probably wouldn't be flooding over there if they weren't dishing out all this free stuff to immigrants, all the welfare. And then also, if we didn't have Zionist-occupied governments, we wouldn't be bombing foreigners and then moving them back into the white countries to live. So we have to pay for both ends. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely right. We need to look at not so much the symptoms, but the cause, the root radical cause, because it is, like you said, it's the wars, the bombing campaigns, the genocide, the destabilization of governments that the Western Anglo-American Zionist Empire don't like, and the economic warfare beyond that, that these companies that globalists and Zionists own are wreaking, you know, chaos throughout the world, from Latin America to Far East Asia to the Middle East. To Europe, you know, so I think we need to look at those things, and if we end those things, I mean, I can only really speak for the United States, but just think about NAFTA. NAFTA has what's caused the biggest influx of immigrants from south of the border here. So, I mean, we got to look at the causes, the economic causes caused by these globalist interests, these Zionist interests. We got to look at the war that causes this immigration. And you're right. If we deal with that, it probably wouldn't even be that much of a problem.
Yeah, it's just a shame for people that haven't been to Europe. You really need to go over there and see how it's being destroyed. I mean, it's cultural genocide, and people don't realize. Some people have actually written me and say, fuck culture, fuck heritage and ancestry. Can you believe that? What would your ancestors say? Do you know all of the depth and the knowledge that's encoded in our mythologies that come from the regions of the parts of the world that we hail from?
I think that, all these things about immigration ultimately don't boil down to the people who are pawns, but really it has to do with the elites, the plutocrats and the oligarchs who are manipulating economies and manipulating governments and destabilizing countries worldwide. And that's the problem.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, on the flip side, you have these kind of airhead new agey people who speak about some of this la-la land collective where ethnicity and heritage is just going to magically fade away and we're going to join hands and meditate together. So you're supposed to just go with the flow and think happy thoughts of love while your lands are being taken over, basically. And then there's some naive conspiracy folks who can't seem to see the conspiracy behind the destruction of nationality or the West. And what's that going to do in the long run, you know?
Right. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that people are not at all concerned about these things because, I mean, really, they rely on them. They wouldn't be in the places that they are without Western civilization is basically everything that people have in the West in many ways. But it becomes a dialectical thing, and it becomes another false paradigm and dichotomy with this East versus West stuff too, because just as much as our culture is Western, there's always been an Eastern influence on Western culture, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. There's always been a Western influence on Eastern cultures. And there is something to diffusionism. It's a shame that it's become a cultural war rather than a positive diffusionism. But, you know, it just goes to show that there's always two sides to the sword, and two sides of the coin, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, society to me, it just seems like there's an organic framework that works together. And clearly that's not the case with multicultural societies, because people are always at each other's throat, and it's crime and it's religious strife. And it's clear various peoples, they need their space from each other. So I always go back to pan-anarchism, too. It's just, we got to take down this big government and have our separate regions and go our separate ways. Otherwise, we're all just going to kill each other off, you know?
I think there's something to that. Like, that's the way to end the culture wars is not to make everybody believe the same thing and have to, you know, love each other and all get along. It's let people go their own ways. So if you want to do the naive, hippie, new age thing, you can. And if you want to do the racial preservation thing, you can. Or you want to do a religious preservation thing, and it's not based on ethnicity, you can. And you could do a multicultural thing that's, you know, based on, you know, American traditions of, you know, libertarian traditions, kind of like how NADA is. And it's fine because it's on a small scale. It's with people who are voluntarily associating, they're voluntarily part of it, or they're intricately part of it if it has to do with, you know, ethnicity and race. It's just part of it. And I think this solves a lot of problems, you know, going back to immigration. Once again, I can only talk about the United States. You know, I think that, you know, regions, I don't even want to talk about as states, but regions around the United States have every right to prohibit, you know, illegal immigrants from coming in, just like I think regions all around the United States have every right, sovereign right, to be, harbor regions or whatever, you know, where they harbor immigrants and allow immigrants free reign, you know, in certain regions. I believe that the communities along the border, if they want to enforce the border, and their militias and their Minutemen, and, you know, want to enforce the border because the federal government won't, because the federal government's obsolete. And maybe the federal government has always been obsolete since at least the Louisiana Purchase.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I think that that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, enforce the border if you see fit, the communities on the border. I live in New York, so I don't even, it's not even that much of a concern to me on the border. Now, are there ethno-separatists and such in New York who don't want to live with Latin American populations or other non-white populations? Yes. And should they be able to live in communities that are like that? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I should be able to live in a community where there's every type of race and every type of religion, you know, very multicultural society. I am very proud of my cultural heritage, and I know quite a bit about my culture. So I'm very comfortable living in the multicultural society. I don't appreciate that it's forced down our throats through the media and through the school system, and I see the agenda behind that.
Yeah.
So I'm very comfortable with it, and I don't really have a problem. I don't feel personally like I need to separate out of it, you know, and I feel very much like I could live in, you know, me and members of NADA lived on a homestead together in an intentional community that we were working on, and it was very multicultural, but we all have the same culture in other ways.
Yeah.
Like, it may have been multicultural in our backgrounds, but we're all Americans, and
yeah,
we're all based, you know, we all have this, we have beliefs in, like, the kind of limited government or anarchistic kind of American Jeffersonian tradition.
You have something that draws you together, but when you take, like, a Muslim and a Christian, it's like it's polar opposites, you know?
Sometimes, I mean, I being from New York, I have exposure to a lot of different peoples, and I know Muslims and Christians who get along quite well. And I know, you know, where they see eye to eye and they can talk. But, you know, because Muslims venerate Jesus in the Quran, and he's quoted quite a bit in the Quran. Isa, they call him, but the same Jesus or Yeshua that the Christians talk about. I mean, their Muslims are more friendly towards the prophet Jesus, Yeshua, than Jews are. Whereas if you look at the Talmud of the Jews, they talk about Jesus being the town idiot. They call him Yoski, I believe they talk about him that he's in hell, you know, boiling in a pot of his own excrement and semen and all these nasty, vile things. So I, you know, personally, you know, if I was a Christian, I would have more, I would have more problems with a lot of the stuff in Judaism than Islam. Now, that's not to say that there aren't streams of Islam that are just as crazy as these streams of Judaism.
And I think they're letting in these types of extremists into Europe on purpose.
Definitely. The Mossad, the CIA, MI6, you know, all working through NATO have definitely done that. And I think it's also been done in Eastern Europe, in Russia, to some extent, too, on purpose, you know, to destabilize, just like the Anglo-American Empire, Zionist Empire goes around destabilizing all these countries around the world. They're also destabilizing their own countries using these radicalized populations who hate the empire. People, you know, there's a lot of pawns, a lot of people who are revolutionaries are pawns.
Well, and there's a lot of pawns in the European government, because I heard yesterday a lady was talking about how these Saudi Arabians are bribing politicians in Europe to allow for this mass immigration, because they're basically, yeah, they want to colonize. It's about spreading Islam, right?
You know, I do believe that there's streams of Islam. I mean, certainly Wahhabi Islam is very much about what you just said. I wouldn't be collectivist and say that all streams of Islam, but certainly the Wahhabist form and certain Shia forms are certainly have an agenda of imperialism.
I just think, come on, Europe, wake up. You're sandwiched between Jews and then also the Muslims. What about tapping into your own ancient heritage? Because I think Christianity, in large part, has destroyed a lot of that. So people have actually forgotten all the good ancient stuff that's there. I mean, you go to Sweden, a lot of people, they're not in touch with the old Viking mythologies, which is rich with all kinds of allegory that I never heard of before.
Yeah, I absolutely. I think that looking beyond, I mean, and see, that's the thing, right? We were talking about West and East, right? That's a great point that you just made. When we talk about the Abrahamic religions, and that's Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, we're talking about, you know, they're somehow Judaism and Christianity are classed as Western, and Islam is classed as Eastern. Yet, Islam comes out of Saudi Arabia, which isn't to the east of Jerusalem, it's to the south. And so, really, what you, like I said before, Western culture has a lot of Eastern culture in it. I mean, if you think about the ancient Greeks, they admit that they were doing a lot of learning from the Persians and the Egyptians. They learned quite a bit of science and mathematics and astrology from those two groups. So the Egyptians and the Persians could be classed as Eastern. Now, and you know, if we want to talk about, you know, since we're talking about European heritage, you know, Indo-European peoples stretch from what's considered the Eastern world to the Western world. That's why I say this West-East dichotomy is kind of bogus. So I would say that you're right about, like, shouldn't Europeans maybe should start looking into their pre-Christian heritage, because in many ways that is an alien culture. That's a more Eastern influenced culture, not to say it doesn't have Western or influences or European influences, blah, blah, blah. But it certainly has Semitic influences, Hamitic influences, African influences via Egypt, because West African religions are influences are evident even in East Africa and in Egypt. So, you know, like I said before, there's been a lot of cultural diffusion. We look at today, globalization and the modern manifestation, but really it's been going on for thousands of years, you know, with ebbs and flows of empires and cultures rising and ebbing and flowing.
And people are migrating.
Migrations of people, right, and discoveries. And, you know, and people have been coming to the Americas for, you know, from the Sultrians to the Asiatics over the Bering Land Strait to a million voyages before Columbus ever got here.
I know, it's a joke that people believe that. Oh, man. Yeah, well, the thing is, too, I think it's what region you come from. There's mythologies, maybe deities and things that people venerated. Those things are literally encoded into our genetics. And I think, you know.
Yes, and the soil, even. Like, see, people don't think about it like that. Maybe, like, there's something to these entities, these deities having a connection to those very territories, to those very places, and an extension of that to those very people.
Exactly. So that's why I get alarmed when I go to Europe and I see people losing this and letting something else override that. That is a genocide,
indeed.
And that is,
I'm
not happy to see that. So
it is understandable. It is an understandable concern, no doubt.
So tell us about National Anarchist Tribal Alliance. What is it? What's going on there?
Well, like we've touched on it a little bit. Yeah, the National Anarchist Tribal Alliance is just a group I started with a bunch of friends and my wife, and you know, it's an anarchist alliance of, well, it's an alliance, let me be straight, it's an alliance of anarchists mostly, but we're a little bit broader than that. We also encompass minarchists, which is just small government people, so that would include like pretty much all Libertarian Party people. That would include, you know, the Patriot Movement, kind of constitutionalist, populist people. So we have some like white nationalists who are kind of a constitutionalist mindset in the group. But mostly anarchists and voluntarists. And we're an alliance of people and groups within that. There's a couple of groups like We Are Change, that's the We Are Change New York City chapter, who is very associated with NADA. And we're traditionally called NADA New York, but more and more we're just dropping the New York and just calling it NADA because we're extended throughout the East Coast to New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut. I believe that's all.
So what's the tactic here to break away from government and succeed? I mean, do we need to form our own secret societies to get things done, or do we have to be a bunch of single cells spread out but united in a cause? What do you say?
Well, I believe in a diversity of tactics, so both those ideas are great. I do believe that secret societies and forming very close-knit societies and networks and cells can be beneficial, but it can also be dangerous if you extend and get too large.
Oh, yeah.
I think lone wolf tactics and leaderless resistance is great and necessary. And I think that intentional community building or enclave building is definitely necessary. And I've been involved in that myself. It's a very hard thing to do. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it takes money to buy land, and it takes committed people. So, but I think all of those ideas plus others, are definitely viable ways to counteract the system that will be way more effective than protesting or leafleting or writing your congressman, blah, 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 or voting or any of that kind of traditional stuff. Now, that's not to say that NADA does not take part in activism like, you know, mass marches and leafleting. We do. But we do realize most of us are vets at that, you know, veterans at that kind of traditional activism. So we do see the limitations of it and know that, like, it's essentially go nowhere. Hopefully you educate some people and maybe you get a few new people involved. And outside of that, it doesn't really do much. So the other ideas, like building intentional communities and building as autonomous and as sovereign enclaves as we from the state as we possibly can, I think is the best idea and that people should start. And if we can start doing that in a network and working together, networking at all different types of tribes, mm-hmm. from ethno tribes to tribes like NADA, and NADA is trying to be that kind of alliance of tribes itself, but like that could be extended, you know, a federation of tribes, and we don't have to all agree on everything or even that much. All we have to agree on is voluntarism, and you know, we're not gonna, you know, try to take each other's territory, you know, and decentralization, and outside of that we got each other's backs, and other than that we mind each other's business, you know.
I think too, where this is going to be one where you're going to get more people over to see the light, so to speak, I think it's imperative mm-hmm. to begin our own alternative systems. I mean, everything from schools
Absolutely.
To making clothes to making our
Absolutely.
Own art and just ditching the old system altogether.
Absolutely, you know, and I guess I should have elaborated on intentional communities, but I think really that's the beginning of alternative institutions. And that's, like you said, alternative schools, our own schools, our own health clinics, our own everything, making our own power, growing our own food. Learning how to make our own electricity, like I said before, power, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, whether it's hydropower, learning how to make fuels if we want to run combustion engines, you know, we could learning how to make biodiesel, ethanol. All of these things are very worthy skills. You know, learning how to live, voluntary simplicity, learning how to live as simply as you can. You know, I think all those things contribute slowly to helping, you know, not only individuals and individual communities get sovereign and free of the system, but it contributes to a gradual collapse of the system, because the system's already starting to collapse. So the more and more people start opting out of it and doing their own thing and doing something separate from that, it's just going to be, you know, more a better chance that the whole thing collapses, and we can start anew.
Yeah, and from what you're speaking about, too, thinking of these communities, I mean, they could be all kinds of different communities. For me, I'm definitely not a collectivist, or I don't want to live in a commune. I like to have my own room. I would probably want to have
right.
my own 5 acres, but I'd like to be surrounded by other people who also want their own 5 acres, so I know what kind of
right.
neighbors I have, you know?
Right. Yeah. No. And exactly. Like, these communities can be based on anything. So they could be communes and communists, or they could be very, you know, like it could be very specific where everybody's got 5 acres or some shit, or it could be very free market, and you know, somebody's got a little bit more land than somebody else, and blah blah blah. You know, the sky's the limit, like I always say, you know what I mean? And it really has to do with the people involved, with how it's going to work out, you know? And I think that's the big point of anarchism. And I think a lot of left anarchists in particular, you know, for lack of a better term, have forgotten that, you know, true diversity means that, true diversity. And their version of diversity is actually a homogenization of everybody.
Yeah, I agree. You can't force anarchy on everyone, right? They have to.
Yeah, and that's something that NADA and national anarchists and many pan-anarchists like Keith Preston from Attack the System have talked about. That in our vision of anarchism, it's really about decentralism and voluntaryism. So essentially, there will be small-scale democracies, small-scale, you know, communism, small-scale dictatorships, just like there'll be, you know, little libertarian enclaves and are just all different, you know, different economies, you know, different religious-based communities, ethno-based. So the sky, like I said before, I keep saying, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, and eventually the government, I wonder, like New Hampshire, for instance, they have the Free State Project. So is the government
right.
keeping an eye, like, that's where all the libertarians are hanging out at? We'll have to keep an eye
yes.
on those folks.
I'm sure the feds and the SPLC are quite aware of these projects, and there's many others. The Free State Project in New Hampshire is a great example. There's also the Blue Ridge Liberty Project down in, I think, South Carolina? Or North? I could
Probably
be
north,
wrong.
It's, maybe North
down
Carolina.
The Carolinas.
Well, so what is your interaction with government since you're kind of living outside the law a little bit? Are you getting attacked for permits and taxes? Or are you able to just do everything on your own?
Well, certainly not. You know, liberty is a very incremental process. And like I said, I've been involved with some intentional community projects on some land that I own that aren't doing that great right now because of certain other people's involvement, not the members of NADA. I had some family members involved, and it didn't work out as great as we had all thought. So in many ways, a lot of the ideas that we discussed, I'm at a loss as to how I'm going to, you know, implement a lot of that stuff, whereas before I had a much clearer vision because we had a lot of the tools there and a lot of the space and land necessary. So now I'm kind of back in New York City for the moment. I have the land upstate, and we go there often, and it's good to have, obviously. But in terms of getting out, I mean, I don't pay taxes because I don't job.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is I can work sometimes. I mean, I'm classified by the state as disabled, essentially, because I have a chronic illness. And there's been times when I was physically disabled, but I at the moment I'm fairly okay. So I don't, you know, have a job on a regular basis, so I don't really pay taxes.
And you're
if I do,
permaculturist, right?
I am by, you know, trade. I do permaculture and horticulture, and, you know, I've worked from working on farms, like my father's farm, and doing the intentional community project up there in my own farm. And I've worked in the city parks here in New York City, and I've worked in you know, people's backyards and, you know, New Haven, Connecticut, you know, working in Yale professors' gardens. So yeah, I've got quite a bit of experience with gardening and such, and you know, I got some other skills, carpentry skills, things like that that I've done over the years. But I look at myself as a jack of all trades.
Well, that's good. That's handy. When shit hits the fan, you got to know how to do a few things. Yeah, I was thinking about that. A lot of anarchists kind of, they don't have two pennies to rub together, and they haven't worked or they haven't saved for some reason. And I think that turns off a lot of women. I wonder, why is it that some of these anarchists haven't been able to, I don't know, start some more of your own businesses?
There's probably many reasons for that, and I'm sure individual initiative is probably the first one. Other than that, I'm sure, you know, opportunity is another one. I personally have been lucky. You know, I did the right thing with the money that I saved before I got so sick that I couldn't work on a regular basis.
Sorry to hear that.
By buying land, and I think that's probably one of the smartest investments you can make. And you know, me and my wife, we have plans. You know, with writing, we do a lot of writing, obviously for NADA and National Anarchism, but we do a lot of writing. Otherwise, both of us are very interested in history and esoteric subjects, and I'm writing a book right now about Native American subjects, mostly kind of, I wouldn't call it Native American spirituality, but it's more like, and I wouldn't just classify it as Native American, because I also talk about ancient Europeans coming to the Americas in the book. But
yeah, I heard that there were tribes of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people that were here that Lewis and Clark saw.
Indeed, yeah, the Lewis and Clark actually was specifically mentioning the Mandan tribe, and a Welsh speaking bands of the Mandan tribe that, like you said, had red and blue, red and blonde hair and blue and green eyes, and spoke a dialect of Welsh or Gaelic, as the Welsh language is. So that's very interesting, and that's not the only example. And the Indo-Europeans of multiple varieties weren't the only pre-Columbian explorers. West Africans and Egyptians and Middle Easterners, Muslims, Hebrews, Phoenicians all came to the Americas prior to Columbus. I mean, obviously, you know, the Norse and the Vikings were coming to the Americas.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, when you said Mandane, that would be like Mondane, that's man of Denmark.
Indeed.
That could explain, because there's a lot of blondies in Denmark.
Indeed, and there's certainly a Celtic connection, you know, an Anglo-Iberian Celtic connection to the Scandinavian countries, particularly like in Scotland. And those connections, you know, are all over the place. Yeah, so I definitely, there's Templars in the Americas, mm-hmm. and before Columbus. So if you look at the Olmec heads, that's a pretty good example of a West African type that mm-hmm. was coming to the Americas before Columbus.
And then we have the giants,
indeed, the Nephilim, the red-haired giants that were found in many of the quote-unquote Indian burial mounds.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, most of my research is of my next upcoming work is focused on such subjects.
And I love all that. I feel like there's so much, obviously, there's so much archaeology and history suppressed on purpose. We don't know jack about where we came from.
Indeed. Yes, here in New York, there's a lot of megalithic structures, from dolems to, you know, menhir standing stones to henges and stone circles, to stone chambers, mound chambers, cairn type things, Noon Grange in Ireland, very similar structures to that are found all over New England. But the highest concentration of these stone chambers are in the Putnam region of New York, which is in the Hudson Valley, just north of New York City.
Wow, it's amazing. Well, since you're into conspiracy, too, that's what I like about you. You can go into the occult, you can go into conspiracy, anarchism, well-rounded. I appreciate that. But
wow, thank you.
Lately, the media loves to talk about how Nazism is a threat and it's on the rise, which I laugh because we all know the Zionists are in charge. But have you looked into government infiltration of supposed white power groups at all?
Well, certainly. I mean, if you've studied the counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO that goes back to the 1930s, the first groups that they were interested in were the Klan and any communist groups. And then like the height of COINTELPRO is like the 60s, and the Klan once again was definitely, you know, high on the list. So I would just assume, based on that information, that it's white nationalists across the board. And then, of course, if you look at, you know, the writings of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who are basically the mouthpieces for government, you know, the counterintelligence programs, or at least they're working. What I mean is they're working to some capacity with the intelligence operations, the government intelligence operations, to collect information. So it's obvious from their publications, like Intelligence Report, that certainly white nationalist groups are being infiltrated just as much as anarchist groups, just as much as patriot groups, militia groups, gangs, communist groups. I think any group is pretty much infiltrated. NADA may also be infiltrated at some level.
Uh-oh. Yeah. Look out. Who do you
Look
trust?
out.
It's funny. It's like the rabbi painting a swastika on his own temple and screaming Nazi. You know, that one cracks me up.
That interestingly that you bring that up, that is a reoccurring problem not too far from where I am right now in Forest Park or Forest Hills, Queens, New York. They're always having that. You know, there's swastikas are showing up, and they find out some like little Jewish guy or rabbi or something.
Do you think that ultimately these COINTELPRO groups want to pit these other groups against each other?
Oh, definitely. It's all about divide and conquer. And, you know, the left, I think, plays into it the most. I'm not saying that the right doesn't play into it at all. Certainly, many, you know, white nationalist groups play right into this kind of culture war stuff. But the left, I think, are the worst. I mean, just speaking from Nada's experience, you know, we have a lot of problems with this whatever quasi group called Antifa and you know, the anti-fascist action. And it what's interesting is Nada considers ourselves anti-fascists. So it's rather funny to us that we're being attacked by a group that calls themselves the anti-fascist action, and
And
they
they're so
claim that we're
violent.
right. They claim we're fascists and we're racists, even though
So.
we have a multicultural group. They claim we're anti-Semites, even though there's at least two people of the, you know, Jewish backgrounds. You know, it's just very odd, you know, but it's certainly, I think, connected to the counterintelligence programs and a divide and conquer tactic that the state has been using, or states have been using, for millennium.
Oh yeah, I agree. The left is far more violent. Are you kidding? Yeah, even in Sweden, the nationalists, they're just like nice, peaceful, gentle. Yet the government-owned media just lies out their teeth about them, saying, you know, how violent they are. All the while the left is guilty of, you know, stabbing people and beating people up, but it just goes under the radar for some reason.
Yeah, well, that has mostly to do with who runs the media, obviously.
Yeah, that's why I wondered too about the neo-Nazi little teens in the Ukraine. They're most likely just paid youngsters in order to make nationalism look bad.
I can't really speak on the Ukrainian thing too much because I just don't know. I tend to only like to address issues here in the Americas, or that America is super directly involved with. That's not to say that there hasn't been some funding of the government that's in Ukraine right now by the United States, and who knows, you know, the funding of certain protesters and blah blah blah. But I don't know all the details, nor do I think anyone will ever know all the details as to that.
Well, so we begin to wrap up. I want to ask you, do you think free speech is heading towards endangered soon?
Well, free speech is definitely endangered all across the world, and I'd say it's funny, I said I don't want to talk about Europe, but particularly in Europe and Canada, I know free speech is a lot more threatened than it is here in America, or in the United States, I mean. Free speech is definitely threatened here in the United States, but I can still question thing, you know, certain historical aspects of the so-called Holocaust or National Socialist Jewish policy. I can still question those things. I can still print materials about those things here in the United States without going to jail or having my property confiscated by the state, which is rather nice. I do have to deal with media smear campaigns and anti-fascist smear campaigns for such sentiments, but that pales in comparison to how the state is arresting and fining and prosecuting and jailing people in all over Europe for questioning how many Jewish people died
Oh yeah.
during World War II, or how exactly they died.
Yep. Oh, I know. It's outrageous. And it should be obvious to people, why is it that we can't question this one aspect? It's just not even up for debate.
I also think it's interesting, NADA's self-described enemies always, talk about my beliefs about the Holocaust, which aren't the beliefs of the whole of all of NADA. We actually internally NADA all kind of disagree about what exactly happened with the so-called Holocaust, and we always say to the anarchists and the leftists who attack us for my personal beliefs, who attack NADA for my own personal beliefs about the Holocaust, we always say, what is 60, 70 year old history have to do with being an anarchist in the 21st century right now?
Well, exactly. That's a good point. Yeah, these smear campaigns, it's nothing about the truth. It's just about if you can win making someone else look bad and get other people to believe it. That's all it is. I mean, some people, they'll Google and they'll see the SPLC site. Oh, they're listed on there. Okay, can't listen to this guy without doing any research of their own. It's amazing.
Indeed.
Well, Craig, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I had a great time, and I'm really honored that you had me on the show. And I hope you have a great night, Lana.
Well, before we say goodbye, you please give out any important websites or details you may have, too.
Well, people can check out NADA on Facebook. We have multiple groups and pages on Facebook. It's NATA-NY. You can do that both capital N and lowercase ATA. You could do it with all uppercases. Or you could spell it all out, National Anarchist Tribal Alliance New York, and you'll find us on Facebook. And you can also check out our website, our blog, which is called, I think the address is nada-newyork@blogspot.com.
All righty. Thanks so much, Craig. It's been a blast.
All right. Thank you. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
It amazes me how many anarchists turn their cheek on the subject of multiculturalism and the government's agenda behind it. It appears that even anarchists have limits and doctrine they adhere to. I'd encourage those to do some honest research into this crucial subject, even for those who have never left their hometown, who have never seen with their own eyes what is unfolding in the Western world. Because these events, whether you know it or not, are taking you farther and farther away from your ideal anarchist society. Eventually, this war will come to your door. This is about being proactive to keep the forces back before it's too late. Yes, I am Abrahamic phobic, aren't you? The West is sandwiched between Jewish supremacists on one end and Islamic extremism on the other. And do you remember what the Christians did to ancient European pagans? I see Europeans polarize on this issue and take one side or the other, but why? None of these are a part of European heritage. Isn't it obvious to you when Jews like Barbara Spector, Annette Kahn, and many other Jewish activists are fighting to make Europe multicultural? Isn't it obvious to you when Islamic extremists in Europe are preaching violence in the streets? The region of the world we come from is woven into the fabric of our DNA. We are encoded with ancestral wisdom, but many of us have turned our backs on it. So it's no wonder the West is in a crisis, because they've cut the roots that ground them, and they've allowed corrupt politicians to rule over them. But I see that as events escalate, Europeans all over the world will wake up, revolt, break away, and rise to new heights. Take care.
Forgotten throne. Up another slide. The heart of love is our only light. Faithless creeds consolidating, holding down sweet charity with Western eyes and serpent's breath, we lay our own conscience to rest, but I'll make it at the view. Yes, I'm breaking at the seams. They have values of a certain taste.
I feel so cold.